investigation to be political. They simply sought the best version of the truth they could find and exposed it. Bernstein has continued in that line ever since in the form of magazine articles, television reporting, commentary, his many books, including All the President's Men, his book about Pope John Paul II called His Holiness, and A Woman in Charge, The Life of Hillary Clinton. P.J. O'Rourke has a name that is hard to type. You have to use the shift key.
It's true. I basically flunked typing in high school because I couldn't type my own
an
name.
Apostrophe.
Yeah,
that's
the
right.
Apostrophe.
Maybe the P period, J period.
De Bernstein.
Yeah. That's right. It's very hard to type. Aside from that, he speaks his own truth in a way that makes it palatable whether you believe it or not, because he's just plain funny. He's written 16 books, including Parliament of Whores, Eat the Rich, and Don't Vote. It encourages the bastards. He also is a research fellow at the Cato Institute, a weekly columnist for the Daily Beast, contributing editor of the Weekly Standard, and his most important job, frequent panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me.
Not my most lucrative job,
really?
I may say.
They don't pay you?
The title's actually in PJ's book pretty much sums up everything we want to say today.
It does.
I think we've done it and we can go.
Okay.
No, they do pay. They do pay the panelists, but they pay them, well, I needn't tell you, NPR.
No, that's right. You needn't tell me that. No. You just rub it in if you want to. That's fine. You are here because of UNC Charlotte, and you spoke last night to an invited audience, and we get to eavesdrop on part of what you said this morning here, but your talk there was called A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the White House. Did you choose that title before the GOP debates began?
Yeah.
Actually, yes. About a year before. And who knew that in the middle of this and the funny thing happening on the way to the White House, the Pope would arrive.
Right, yeah.
And quite change the context, I think, of what certainly I intended to say. And I began last night by noting that there was something extraordinary about the Pope and his message, particularly that of humility, in the midst of this institution that is totally dysfunctional, that really has broken our government to the point that one of our three branches is just counted out for in terms of the common good, which was a phrase that the Pope used. And here was this alien arrived in the midst, and these folks in the Congress were on their feet and fascinated and seemed to be paying rapt attention and lauding him. And the interesting thing, of course, will be to see, well, he said all the right things that they ought to be thinking about and doing, and the purpose of politics, which is to serve each other, which has almost nothing to do with what they do there regularly. And the question is, well, is this going to be a one-day wonder, or will it really have some effect on them?
One-day wonder.
You think? I heard an NPR.
How affected they were emotionally. Well, maybe they're capable of one-day emotional affection.
Their takeaway on this.
Much more.
The congressional takeaway on this will be, Pope came to Congress. Great. This Pope came to Congress. Okay. This gives me such a wedge in with my Catholic campaign donors. That's their takeaway.
Well, John Boehner was in tears for much of it.
John tears up easily.
I know.
Yeah, he's often in tears on like the fourth tee.
He smokes and cries.
Speaking of which, I've got a little Boehner anecdote. We're at a dinner on the roof of the Hay Adams Hotel, which is directly across the White House. From the White House, and on the roof I forget what the dinner was about, but anyway, Boehner and I are both there. Boehner and I both smoke. And there's a little balcony out there, and we stepped out on the balcony to have a smoke, and we're chatting out there. And I look across, and I see the laser light and the snipers from the top of the White House looking at us on the roof of the Hay Adams, you know, right across Lafayette Park. And I'm going, it's the Speaker of the House. I mean, you take out me. Yeah, I mean, that's not going to cause any problems. That's the Speaker of the House over there with his Marlboro light. And fortunately, no triggers were pulled.
I heard an NPR commentator this morning talking about the Pope's visit to Congress, and the Pope said some things that would be not not popular with Republicans, and some things that would be popular with Republicans because of his stance on abortion and things like that. But the commentator was essentially saying that perhaps he was providing the Republican Party a way out of the gridlock they find themselves in, unable to do anything because of having to play to the base. I'm not sure I understood that, but do you?
No, I don't, and I don't think it's true.
That's the thing about commentators.
Yeah.
they get to say things like that. And of course, if logic were to hold and you were going to think about it, perhaps the commentator might be right. But there is nothing in the history of their actions in the Congress to indicate, look, what the gospel partly really is the notion of finding God's will and doing the next right thing. Well, I think the odds of the people in the Congress of the United States doing the next right thing in terms of their responsibilities, they got a pretty established record on it. And if this one-day visit were to change that, as we've been saying, that would indeed be miraculous, and the Pope right there might be qualified for sainthood on the basis of that miracle.
Yeah, that would probably do it. Actually, I do think, though, there is a message from the Pope that especially socially conservative Republican candidates should take away, which is, listen, you know, whatever your position is, make it clear that you may hate the sin, but you love the sinner. You know, I mean, that's basically what Pope Francis has been doing. Pope Francis has not come out and say, okay, we're changing the rules, you know. The church is, we're down with gay marriage now. That's cool, you know. And, like, you can have abortions and get divorced all you want. And everything's, like, different now. You're Unitarians now, okay? You're Unitarians with the Pope. That's not been his message, but his message has been one of not just tolerance, but compassion, empathy, understanding, giving the world a hug.
Both in his... Go ahead.
If I can interrupt for 1 second here about some of the commentary, which is this great surprise, perhaps, or some people taken aback at what this Pope has said about the nature and excesses, as it were, of capitalism and the free market and what the responsibilities are of the United States and other capitalist countries in terms of serving one another, as if this were something new in its radicalism. It's almost exactly the same message that Pope John Paul II preached with great vehemence. After the fall of the Soviet Union, John Paul II was absolutely apoplectic in his speaking about what he called the excesses of capitalism, as much so as when he preached against communism. So that what this Pope Francis is saying about capitalism goes to the very nature of Catholic social teaching, which is the great contribution in many ways of the Catholic Church to mankind. That Catholic social teaching is about caring for each other.
I so disagree.
A steward for what we have here in our earthly existence and taking care of it on behalf of each other, so that
I completely disagree.
Radicalism is the gospel itself.
To my mind, Catholic Church is a very old institution.
What he's saying here.
Yeah. Catholic Church is a very old institution, 2,000 years old, as a matter of fact. There's an irony in the Catholic Church. Jesus says to St. Peter, he says, upon this rock, he's making a pun, because Peter means Petrus is Greek for rock. He says, upon this rock I found my church. Well, if you recall your Bible, St. Peter denied Christ 3 times before cockcrow and was, in general, a hothead and, you know, probably the least reliable among the disciples. And Jesus is making a joke. He's saying, you know, on this fallible humanity, I found my church. So we must always remember that the church is an institution of men. It's not an institution foremost of God. And I consider the Catholic Church to be mired. It's an old institution, and it's mired in old misconceptions about a number of things, chief among which, in my mind, is economics. It is mired in a pre-industrial revolution, zero-sum sort of agrarian economics, where if I have a plot of land, you can't have it. and there's only so much to go around, and it must be divided up evenly. We know that since the Industrial Revolution, that's just not true. We can make more of everything. If you have too many slices of pizza, I don't have to eat the Domino's box. We can make more pizza. On another issue, sex, sexuality, love, if you will. The Christian church was born at a time when women had absolutely no rights. Women were chattel. Slaves were sexually – it was open season on slaves. The aristocracy of the time, one of the most accepted forms of sexuality was what we would call child abuse. The very thing – it so happens that the church has been in terrible trouble for over the past few years. And so Christianity, when it comes in, it didn't seem at the time to be puritanical. It seemed to give dignity to women, and to object to people being sexually abused and sexually exploited. It was actually a huge social advance, the Christian, but it's out of date. It doesn't recognize things like two adult gay people having a marriage and a relationship.
But it put, and I thought you were going to be funny, but.
No, we got kind of failed, flunked that.
But yeah. But it puts the Catholic Church in a tough position, doesn't it? Because a lot of things that the dogma is immutable.
Well, it's not immutable, well, but it moves
the
glacial.
Position on many, many things over the millennia. And certainly when you listen to this Pope, it's possible sometimes to think, given his emphasis, that he's looking for a way to bring the church into some kind of conformity with the real and modern world. And
maybe.
And there's no question that particularly in the West, but really all over the world, the question of what in the long run the Catholic Church is going to do with its with dogma that is not consistent with treating women equally is the biggest long-range question, perhaps, and problem that the Church faces, because there's something inherent in the doctrine. If you can't have women priests, for instance, what does that say about the faith itself?
Well, it does. Of course, these things do change. For instance, papal infallibility is a concept that is only about
300 years, I think.
No. It's only 175. It's from Vatican I, Pope Leo. And Lord Acton, when Lord Acton said power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely, he wasn't talking about terrible regimes, lousy kings or horrible dictators. He was talking about the Pope. He argued against papal infallibility, and he was actually talking about the Pope, a Pope whom we liked, and he was a devout Catholic. And that's where that quote comes from. So church doctrine does change. In that case, it changed for the worse, but it does change. But it's glacial. I mean, this is a 2,000-year-old institution.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to shift this conversation to American politics, which is something that
I know a lot more about.
Well, no, but it's not that it engages a lot more people because, believe it or not, not everybody's Catholic. And that's news.
Carl, just for instance.
Carl, for one, yeah. Carl Bernstein and P.J. O'Rourke, our guest this morning at Charlotte Talks on WFAU. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and LRC Language Resource Center, providing professional interpreters and translators for spoken and sign languages, including document translation, on-site phone and video interpreting. Details at languagerc.com. And Alta Vista Wealth Management, providing personal investment strategies, financial planning, and advice. Ned Zorrigan has more information at 866-684-2600 or altavistawealth.com. On Monday, on this program, our guest is a piano, a 9-foot Steinway & Sons grand piano that belonged to the late Vladimir Horowitz. It's a gift of the great pianist back in the 1940s. It's traveling the world now, as it did with Vladimir Horowitz. And on Monday, guest host Duncan McFadden talks to some Steinway experts about the piano. And we hear from Chad Lawson, a great local pianist who will entertain us with some chart-topping selections from his chart-topping album of Chopin's music. That's Monday at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the Friday News Roundup, Pope Francis brings his political agenda to Washington. Hillary Clinton comes out against the Keystone XL pipeline, and American car owners react to the Volkswagen emissions scandal.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, backing up in front of our Spirit Square studio. We've been talking about the Pope is a truck that says Roma on it. It's a sign.
Might be the Pope himself.
PJ O'Rourke is with us in the studio. Carl Bernstein joins us by phone from New York, where he's been called back to cover the Pope in New York, I believe, for CNN. You started this conversation, Carl Bernstein, by calling the House, and I think the government in general, at least the House and Senate, a broken branch of our government, and one which you believe the Pope had a profound effect on. At least that's what you said last night. How so? Really?
I think his presence and what he was saying is a profound experience, given what we come to expect of the Congress of the United States. Whether it has any effect on the members and their conduct, if I were in Vegas, I would put some pretty long odds on it. They're very good at seeming to pay attention and seeming to consider loftier thoughts, and then going about their business as they always do in the ditch. So I wouldn't be too hopeful here. At the same time, the message that he brought, he believes in a purpose for politics of the common good, of responsibilities toward each other, and on the issues that he mentioned that have to do with how we treat each other as neighbors, as human beings, as the gospel itself proclaims. You would think that those principles might be basic to what those 535 people in that broken institution concern themselves with.
Again, I disagree. I don't consider this institution to be broken at all. I really don't. I do not. One of the reasons I do not is that, well, are they being legislatively effective? Not particularly, and which is fine by me.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear that, PJ.
I was saying, are they being legislatively effective? No, and that's fine by me. They've passed enough legislation. We've got plenty of laws. I just think Congress accurately reflects a split, an almost 50-50 split in American opinion. Half of Americans want more benefits and social services to be paid for by other people, and half of America is other people. It's really basically that simple. People say, oh, we're so polarized. No, we're not. 1862, that was polarized. 1862.
But aren't there echoes of that today? Don't you see echoes?
I don't really see anybody shelling Fort Sumter current.
PJ's point is a real one, and that is, you know, what's the chicken and what's the egg here? The Congress of the United States, in terms of, is reflective of the country itself, and it's hard to know, well, you know, what emanates from Washington and what emanates from the people of the country, and that those people in Congress are expressing the will of the people in terms of the polarization that we have. At the same time, there's a lot more involved than just passing or not passing legislation. There's the whole question of responsibilities that we have in our institutions to, let's take a look at infrastructure as the most basic of questions. How in the world you would think that it is possible for sentient people to agree that the infrastructure of this country is falling apart, given who we are and what we aspire to and what our capabilities are. We got bridges falling into rivers. We got a grid that is eons behind the times, as well as a national security threat in terms of its security, and doesn't work very well. We've got roads. If you look at European roads, it's like we're in the Dust Bowl here. So you look at these most basic of functions that obviously this Congress of the United States, this institution, is incapable of dealing with. The argument over the size of government is one thing, but the notion that somehow there is no responsibility. Let's take a look at food safety, for instance, that the Congress of the United States is not responsible for passing laws that keep us safe from contaminated food. There are all kinds of regulatory areas that indeed there is a function of government, and the idea that...
Again, I disagree. I just completely disagree. Infrastructure. When government gets effective about infrastructure, does our local street get with all its potholes get paved? No, we get the big dig in Boston. Billions and billions of dollars come out of my pocket to bury a highway that they shouldn't have built in the first place. And where are they burying it? Boston. I live 70 miles from Boston. I don't go there. Why don't I go there? Mainly because of the big dig. It's been, even now that it's finished, things fall off it. Land on cars.
Bureaucrats of all dimensions, in all levels of government, in all levels often of private enterprise, let's take the phone company, let's take Verizon or some other institution like that, and are they much better in terms of providing their services in a way that makes us happy?
Well, that's a logical fallacy known as tukoke. You cannot defend against an attack by saying, well, you do it too, or somebody else does it also. The thing with food regulation to take,
but there are.
Wait, so just a second, Carl. I mean, let's take your second example, food regulation. Well, food regulation would seem like something that the government naturally should do. We don't want like green bologna poisoning our children at their school lunch.
Right.
But when the government steps in to do food regulation, what do they do? They're going to set up insane standards for GMA, for genetically modified foods. That you got to post all this and label all of this, and it is nowadays impossible because all of our food is genetically modified. It simply is impossible to escape genetically modified.
But isn't that because the Congress refused to pass laws about that?
It's because of the nature of farm...
Hold it, we're all talking at once here.
It's the nature of farm technology. It's simply the nature of... Genetically modified foods have saved probably a billion lives around the world.
PJ is not that aspect. You can have a debate on what the standards ought to be about genetic modification of food, and that's a large issue that is addressed in the culture in all kinds of ways, including legislation, and whether legislation is appropriate or not. Let them argue that. But in terms of basic safety, keeping the bologna from turning green, that one of the reasons we have such a reasonable degree of safety is because of legislation.
Maybe. Or the market. You know, people hate buying bologna that kills them. Carl doesn't believe in markets.
Look at places without regulation and see what the rates of poisoning are, and they're quite...
What I am saying here, though, is when you ask the government to do something, what you generally get is not what you ask for. You ask the government to punish the dog, the government will kick the cat. And I'm not saying it happens 100% of the time, but it happens often enough we should keep our eye open for the possibility.
No question. I'd certainly agree with that. And the amount of waste, abuse, and fraud at all levels of government is atrocious. But does that mean that we ought to just sit back and say, oh, screw it, let's not have government involved in the questions of our lives like building roads?
Sometimes the answer is yes.
The local government doesn't necessarily have the ability to build a big bridge over a big river.
So this very back and forth that we're experiencing here right now is, I think, emblematic of what's happening in the country and probably is emblematic of what is happening in the presidential race because we have all these
people. I wish that the presidential race were as substantive the argument is that
but
Carl and I
But
are
is
having.
That the fault of the media or is that the fault of the candidates? The candidates aren't going to offer any points if they're not pressed on them.
First and foremost, it's the fault of the candidates. I mean, the media is just, we're just eyes and ears. We may be and mouths.
I'm not sure that's true.
I mean, we may be.
When the media controls the question at presidential debates and they're asking about things that are not
trivialities,
substantive,
yeah.
then they're culpable.
Well, we do bear culpability.
They're also playing to a base. Those 17 people, which in the Republican debate, for instance, and we can talk about the Democrats in another part of the conversation, and they're not breaking any records to having a great substantive debate, though it seems to be a good deal better than what's going on the Republican side so far. But those 17 people who have been engaged in this debate, they are playing to the base of the voters of their party. And,
well, the question is, why is the base so base?
yes,
well,
indeed.
There you have it.
Yeah, because think about who goes to vote in primaries. You know, I'm sure many a listener is going to feel like I often feel a certain amount of guilt that they're not down there voting in a primary because it's held at like 2 o'clock in the morning, 70 miles away, and, you know, in some place the GPS can't get you to. Or you forget about it. You have kids to raise and a job to go to and so on. In both parties, it is very few people who come out to vote in the primaries, and almost none of those people who come out to vote for the primaries are people we'd like to take a road trip with.
But the popularity of Donald Trump, who is still the Republican frontrunner, he won't be in the end. But
no, he won't be.
He is now. He's expressing a lot of the anger and frustration and dissatisfaction that helped create
and incoherence and idiocy.
Well, there's one other thing that Trump is doing that's really interesting, and that is the notion that he's saying, you know what, all of you up here are hypocrites, and indeed, at least I'm up here saying the truth as I say it. I'm not bound by the focus groups that you all convene before you, and a word comes out of your mouth. I'm not bound by the same rules of polytest that the rest of you seem to think is necessary to appeal to the voters, and that's quite extraordinary, and it's having a real effect. So his appeal goes not just to the prejudices that the commentators and the commentary that has had such a ball noting, and the fact that he's a bully and the fact that he's ignorant on many of the issues, but there seems to be, both anecdotally and just watching him and the polls, an awful lot of evidence that people are identifying with what he's saying, because he's saying, to hell with all of you. At least I'm up here saying what logically comes out of my mouth is being expressed without all of this political, the word political correctness.
Well, that's what it is. But
at the same time, there is something to it in this instance, or without the filtering, and it's having a great effect.
I just think that when you've got like a really dull party, and the GOP certainly qualifies for that, it's a really dull party. The noisy, unfiltered loudmouth with the lampshade on his head, like, is pretty entertaining.
But it's also more than that. It's not just him. It's Carly Fiorina. It's Ben Carson. It's people who are not part of the system who are in there running for president, and people are finding that refreshing. Why are they finding that? We wouldn't expect you to run Hewlett-Packard. You don't know anything about corporations, I would think.
Wouldn't expect me to do any brain surgery.
Right, I was going to say, that was my next point. So why do we expect a brain surgeon?
Okay, I've got the butter knife and the fork.
Remember, Ross Perot had big numbers in a previous Republican primary season. And he faded. It's not entirely new, this phenomenon that people come into primaries without having.
No, I think this is a common. This is just an ordinary. Just regard this psychologically. When you are stuck between a rock and a hard place, you've either got to you've got to move to someplace you don't want to go in order to keep your job, or if you stay where you are, you're going to lose your house. And it's tempting to think, oh, gosh, there must be some third way that I can do this. Maybe I can go back to school and become a chiropractor, you know. And this is what the voters do periodically with guys like Ross Perot.
Let me interrupt here for just a second. We have breaking news, and that is that the Speaker of the House, John Boehner, has announced that he will retire from Congress at the end of October. What's your take on that?
That he wants to play more golf.
My take is, to be totally stunned, and that certainly I have no idea of what has precipitated this. And it's a remarkable event, and I'm going to get off the phone in about 3 minutes. We've got a break, and go do some reporting.
So we also have Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side running for Congress. I mean, running for president, excuse me, and he is a socialist. 50 years ago, he would have been put in jail for that.
Yeah, it should be now, as far as I'm concerned. I'm not just a guy. I think the guy's a complete idiot. He does not understand anything about modern economics, anything about modern politics. Socialism doesn't work. I mean, it's been proven over and over again all around the world.
He's a socialist, but at the same time, PJ, his message is not one of classic socialism. He's not saying in this campaign, let's nationalize the car industry. Though we had a little bit of supervision of it during the recession, but he's not conveying a socialist message.
So he's saying, here's what I believe in and I won't do it.
No, I don't think that's what he's saying. I think
what is he saying?
He's conveying a fairly not much different than what Elizabeth Warren, not much different than what Hillary Clinton is saying at this point about what the responsibilities are of a government to the people and what its function is and how it needs to operate and what the programs are, particularly, though, in terms of regulation of the banks, of regulation of Wall Street. I think it's a pretty mainstream and desirable message for even some Republicans.
But is it electable?
In fact, it's, Trump is...
No.
Has gone somewhere in that corner at various times.
So if you have these two extremes, you've got the Bernie Sanders on the one hand, you've got Donald Trump, the capitalist extraordinaire, on the other hand.
I don't think of Donald Trump as an extreme in anything except bad taste and behavior. Ideologically, the guy doesn't have enough thoughts in his head to really place him on. As Carl says, he's all over the place. You can't really place him on the political spectrum.
So that leaves who? Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush, ultimately?
If he had to put money on it right now, and it would be a fool of a bet, but, I mean, that's who you'd bet on. Might be Joe Biden on the Democratic side. It might be like sort of Kasich Rubio, something very like Jeb Bush. Mm-hmm. Kasich would be a stand-in for Jeb Bush.
We only have a minute left in this, and I'm going to lose Carl Bernstein in a second. But what went wrong with Jeb Bush? Is it just Bush fatigue in general in the country?
Well, that certainly is a big thing. The other thing, he is just not exactly an electric personality, is he? You know, I mean,
well, neither is Ben Carson. He's doing better than Jeb Bush.
But also, what he too has been dragged by playing to the base even farther than ordinarily he might. Trump has dragged him into positions that you might think are at odds with his record. And this is a problem for the Republican Party, that Trump has dragged all of these candidates into positions that are not going to play well after there is a nominee. And the Democrat, whoever that nominee is going to come back and hammer the hell out of them on some of the things that they've said in these debates.
But that doesn't really explain why he's doing so poorly at the moment.
Let me stop you there. We have to take a break. And Carl Bernstein, I know that you have to leave to go and report for CNN. I thank you for your time. We'll continue in a moment with more of P.J. O'Rourke. Thank you both for being here, by the way.
Good to be with you.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Honda of Concord, committed to customer service satisfaction and bringing excellence to the car buying experience, offering a selection of over 700 new and pre-owned vehicles. Details at hondaofconcord.com. And the law firm of Horak Tally, helping individuals and businesses find sharp solutions to their legal needs for more than 80 years. Details at horaktally.com. Coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, it's the weekly news roundup, the National Hour, full of stories about Pope Francis bringing his political agenda to Washington, then to New York, and of course over the weekend to Philadelphia. Hillary Clinton comes out against the Keystone XL pipeline, and American car owners react to the Volkswagen emissions scandal. A panel of journalists joins Diane to talk about the week's national stories at 10, the International Hour at 11. Coming up on WFAE.
They say you are what you eat, so how much media do you consume every day? Are you gorging yourself on everything in sight, snacking between meals, sneaking the occasional tweet? I'm Audie Cornish. Look, if you've tried all the other news outlets but just aren't seeing results, check out the All Things Considered diet, weekdays. More news, less filler.
Hear the latest news from NPR, plus WFAE news updates from the Charlotte region on All Things Considered, weekdays from 4 to 6:30 p.m. on WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with P.J. O'Rourke from the Daily Beast and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and many other publications, the Weekly Standard and 16 books. Carl Bernstein just left us, and now you'll get a word in edgewise.
Well, you know, Carl is much more interested in retail politics and pays better attention, yeah, in fairness, to retail politics than I do. I like to keep this stuff at an arm's length, at least.
I want to repeat the breaking news that we mentioned a second ago. The New York Times is reporting that John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, will resign from Congress and give up his House seat at the end of October. Mr. Boehner has been under extreme pressure from the right wing of his conference over whether or not to defund Planned Parenthood in a bill to keep the government open. That doesn't seem like something you would resign over, though, does it?
No, it seems like there must be more to this. But I think Boehner's just worn out. You know, the Republican House majority has been a sack full of cats, and he's been, you know, sent to tent for all these years, and I think he's just exhausted and trying. I mean, Boehner himself is a pretty conservative person. You would think he would be a good person to bring some unity, but you've got a weird combination there of professional politicians, Tea Party hotheads, idealistic people with no experience of actual practical politics.
Well, that gets us back to the presidential race. We have these newcomers who are not part of the system.
Yeah.
They won't even know where the men's room is,
no,
for most of them. And then you've got people in the electorate who want the government to run like a business. Well, the government isn't a business.
A, the government isn't a business. And B, HP stock went down 43% while Carly Fiorina was CEO. Somebody my age, you know, with an IRA, you know, and a Keio plan is alert to these things.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to really warm toward her, even though she's been a better debater.
Well, let's talk about Hillary Clinton for a second, because Carl says that she has had a difficult – and he's written a book about her.
Yeah, right. He knows more than I do.
She has had a difficult relationship with the truth. But my question to him was going to ask, I'll ask it to you, was going to be, don't they all? They're politicians.
Don't they all, yeah. I think that, the example that we gave, let's see, it's a little bit of a colorful example. So she just doesn't know how to lie right. When Bill Clinton says, the dog ate my homework, he brings the dog poop wrapped in newspaper to class with him and says, you want to look. She just doesn't seem to know how to do this.
Well, that brings up the whole email server situation.
I'm like too old to understand. I can't. I'm a guy who can't get a dial tone on my smartphone, you know. So, you know, the idea you have two. What first place, what is a server exactly? And like, you know, why would she have two of them? You know?
And why would the government let her have it? Why would she want to have it? And you knew she probably thought at some point she might run for president again. So why would you want that hanging out there? Why would you do that?
Well, so this is one of the things that, like, worries me about Hillary Clinton is that there are times, and I don't mean this in an IQ sense, but there are times when she just doesn't seem so smart. You know, and this would be one of those times. The bungling over Benghazi, I don't happen to believe in any sort of like horrible conspiracy theory or anything there, but I do feel that the State Department bungled the mm-hmm. handling of that crisis as it was happening. There are times when she just doesn't like seem to like get it. And
if you believe the reports that Condi Rice went to the President Bush and said Al Qaeda is going to attack the United States mm-hmm. several weeks before it actually happened or several months before it actually happened, and it kind of fell through the cracks and we ended up with the World Trade Centers collapsing. That's a bungle as well. I mean,
these bungles happen.
We're all human, right?
Yeah, these bungles happen all the time. But I mean, you have to be like. You just have to be clever and fast about this. The Condi Rice thing, in my opinion, is I think she came with good information to the president, and I have a feeling the president listened to her. But the problem with that kind of prognostication is like the problem we have with economists. Economists can tell us with great accuracy what will happen. What they cannot tell us is how much and when. And those are the only two things that we're interested in, is how much and when.
Yeah.
And I think Condi Rice was completely right, and probably all the other sources of people behind her, when they said Al-Qaeda is going to attack the United States. But how much and when and where?
During your conversation with Carl Bernstein last night at UNC Charlotte, something else came up that nobody's talking about, really, but not many people are talking about it. That is, you believe, I think both of you believe, that the Clinton Foundation is highly problematic, and perhaps more so than anything else in the
Clinton campaign. Don't believe that the server thing, let alone Benghazi, is going to be the, you know, the boat anchor that sinks the the Hillary raft. But the Clinton Foundation would seem to really smell of conflict of interest. I mean, here you have the Secretary of State running around dealing with all of America's friends and enemies and frenemies, and then you have all these heads of state giving huge amounts of money to the foundation that the husband of the Secretary of State is. You know, this just wouldn't pass the local Rotary Club smell test. You know, I mean, if this were going on in a small town with a tiny charity and a local city council member, this would.
Well, the Clintons have been accused of playing loose and fast with the truth, but they kind of have Teflon coatings. It doesn't ever seem to.
Well, Bill does. Think. I'm not sure any other member of the Clinton family has that Teflon coating that Bill does. Bill's one of those guys. We all knew him growing up. There was always a kid in our class or a kid in the neighborhood who could just get away with anything. You know, and they just, you know, but he'd put on that, like, who was the character in Leave It to Beaver?
Eddie Haskell.
Eddie Haskell. He'd put on that Eddie Haskell smile and a smarm, and the next thing you know, everybody's, oh, that Eddie Haskell, you know, he's such a, you know, he's a rogue, you know. And,
you know. You, in talking about this season's political campaign, have compared it to Animal House. And if anybody knows Animal House better than you, I don't think they exist on the planet.
Oh, no, they do. Yeah, Chris Miller, who wrote the short stories that it was based on, he's still around and he knows it better than I do. But, yes.
And you said it's the worst you've ever witnessed. Why?
Well, it's the worst in terms of poor candidates confused about what they want to do and who they want to be, and voters can understandably confused about all this. I probably exaggerate in saying it's the worst, but it is or maybe I'm just sick of it. I've been doing this like the 12th presidential campaign that I have covered as a reporter or a commentator, and maybe I've just run out of patience with the whole process. Maybe if I went back and looked at the other 11, I would think that they were just
That leads me to a question from a listener, Rick on Twitter. It says, I don't want to put PJ out of a job, but what is the road back to less pervasive cynicism about the federal government? Is it part of the problem here maybe that a lot of the commentators on television are older because they have wisdom, they have experience.
They have jobs, and they're not giving them up for younger kids.
Yes, right. But they're also tired and cynical.
They are tired and cynical. We're all, you know, getting tired and cynical. Unfortunately, the answer to the kind of structural problems that Carl was talking about, of the, you know, a Congress is like so deadlocked that they can't even get a bridge built, even if the bridge doesn't go to any place, would probably be the case with the bridge that did get built. But anyway, when you have this kind of stasis and this kind of discontent and so on, unfortunately, the only thing that fixes something like this is a crisis. And you don't want that crisis. You don't want that crisis. What finally fixed the Great Depression? You know, was it the New Deal? Was it, you know, it wasn't. It was World War II. Well, you don't want World War II. There's a great French economist, Frederick Bastiat, who called this the fallacy of the broken window. And he said, when somebody says, oh, a broken window, well, that gives an opportunity to glazers, you know, and to glass manufacturers and to mullion mutton makers and to street cleaners who get to sweep up the broken glass. This stimulates the economy. He said they're not counting the cost of the broken window. So when we say, oh, World War II was beneficial, it popped the world out of a terrible worldwide depression, well, we're not counting 100 million dead. Is that the price we want to pay? So this you know, frustration that we have, this sort of stasis, this mire that we're stuck in governmentally will be fixed. Unfortunately, it will be fixed by something that will make us wish for the mire and the stasis and and the muddle that we had before.
We as a society, have kind of gone into this cocoon. We've found our little cocoons where we retreat and we want to hear only things that we already agree with and think and know and believe. And much of the blame for that, because it's been going on for about 25, 30 years, we've been in a culture war and it's resulted in this cocooning.
Yeah.
Much of the blame for that has got to rest on the shoulders of the baby boom generation, about which you have written in your book, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again.
Yeah, that I can, last part I can promise.
So how did it get this? How did we go from love and peace and make peace, not war, to Fox News and MSNBC? How did we get there?
Well, as is so often the case in life, the explanation is just dully economic. What you have with the baby boom is the first really huge generation in the history of Earth to be, by historical standards, rich. You have the richest, largest group of people in the history of the world, and what do they end up doing? They end up acting like rich kids, like spoiled brats, and they want things their own way. The reason people cocoon themselves in a little you know, wrappings of opinions that they like, the reason that the crunchy granola people up where I live in New Hampshire can't understand why everyone isn't obsessed with composting, and the reason that the uncrunchy, grumpy old Republicans like myself can't understand why everybody isn't obsessed with bird shooting, is that we're rich kids. We cocoon ourselves because we are financially able to cocoon ourselves.
But we're also the most educated generation in the history of the world, and yet we seem to not want to hear the truth if it conflicts with our own preconceived notions of the truth.
Well, we don't want to hear things that annoy, embarrass us.
But why? We're supposed to be smart.
Why? Because people don't want to do that. I mean, people can be as smart as they like and still don't like psychological discomfort, you know. I mean, it's not a matter of intelligence. It's a matter of ability. During something like World War II, you couldn't protect yourself against, against hearing things you didn't want to hear, like the Japanese bomb Pearl Harbor. Who wanted to hear that, you know? But there it was, and it affected everybody's life. Now most of the things you don't want to hear really don't affect everybody's life in an immediate sense. And so we have the luxury of not listening to them.
Mm-hmm. And then we have a media who's covering this, who covers all presidential campaigns like a horse race, really.
Of course.
And we don't get into a lot of policy. We get into a lot of the glamoring glitz. And
it's sports. You know, it's a sport.
It's sports. And people criticize us for that, and they bemoan the fact that we do that. And not everybody does it, but it's done.
Yeah.
But when you think about it, does it really matter? In the face of Citizens United, does it matter?
Because
the voters aren't making these decisions anyway, are they?
Well, yes, they are, fundamentally. I'm not a great believer in the idea that money, that excess campaign spending affects politics to the extent that we like to think that it does. And the reason I don't feel that way is because I don't feel you can buy politicians. You can only rent them. They don't stay bought. You know, they're not like honestly corrupt. they take all your money, they say thank you, and then they do what they want to do anyway. And, I really don't. But back to the media is one of the problems is simply technology. Media used to have to be filtered just because of the nature of broadcast media, print media,
Well, there was there were things called the Fairness Doctrine and equal time provision.
But you know, even if the Fairness Doctrine hadn't existed, the fact that television was a mass audience medium when there were only three channels, mm-hmm. four counting educational TV, which nobody watched, was that you had to please everybody. It's like going to watch a very violent shoot 'em up movie from the 1940s to the 1950s. You will find in that movie there's a love scene. There may even be a cowboy playing a guitar because that movie had to appeal to everybody, not just teenage boys, but it also had to appeal to their moms who were going to the theater once a week too. Television was always like that. So television was careful to have a broad appeal. Radio was careful to have a broad appeal. And nowadays, when there are millions and millions and millions of media outlets, you can go for niche markets, and we do.
But can you run a country this size as a democratic republic where everybody has balkanized, everybody has gone to their own little niche and are only hearing the reverberations of their own thoughts?
Well, apparently, yes.
But can you run it for a long time, or does it flat?
What John Maynard Keynes said, you know, in the long run, we're all dead. I don't really want to go to the long run thing, but yeah, apparently, we've been living with this situation for a couple decades now, and the world has not ended.
The other question I wanted to ask both of you, and I'll ask you because you're the only one standing. You both talked about how politicians no longer want to work for the common good.
No, we didn't both talk about it. Carl talked
about
that.
Okay, well, let me, if you believe that, is that because the people don't want the common good? They want what's good for them?
No, I think it's just the nature of politics. They work for themselves. They always have. Every now and then a crisis will cause a great leader to come to the fore, but you don't want the crisis, so therefore you don't want the great leader.
P.J. O'Rourke with the Daily Beast and the Weekly Standard, and of course, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and 16 books to his credit. Carl Bernstein, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, joined us earlier, and I want to thank UNC Charlotte for making that possible. And thank you for being here this morning, too.
Well, you're very welcome.
Nice to have you.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. Our producers are Aaron Kiever and David Borax. The engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, archives, upcoming shows, and podcasts, or to continue the conversation online, go to wfae.org/charlottetalks.
And support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Theater Charlotte, presenting La Cage aux Folles, a musical comedy in a drag club where a middle-aged gay couple hides their relationship from their son's fiancé.